Welcome, pudding people, to another episode of Everybody Loves Pudding. I am your host, Ken Seymour. At least for the first half of this episode, doing something just a little bit different, we are dividing the episode into two pieces. Up front here, I'm going to talk just a little bit about the last half of season four of The Boys. This will be followed up by some thoughts from our fantastic Mr. Richard Geiger, talking about the Legion, the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. It's going to be a fun one. We just had so much we wanted to talk about. We couldn't quite smush it into a single episode. And I wanted to finish talking about The Boys more, and he wanted to talk about this other really awesome thing. It's like, well, all right, divide and conquer. That's what we're going to do. So I'll tell you what, folks, this is going to be spoiler heavy on both of these. And so if you haven't seen them, you should definitely go out and see them before you listen to the episode a little bit. In both instances, I'm pretty sure that Richard is going to say that that he is really a fan of the Ungentlemanly Warfare. I know we both liked The Boys, and The Boys has just been fantastic. So don't miss out. If you haven't watched it, so long as you're okay with a great deal of violence and language and nudity and weirdness and things going from bad to worse a lot, then you'll always love The Boys. And season four just keeps it coming. So we talked a little bit about the beginning of the season four already. The key players in the show are still just knocking it out of the park. I mean, Carl Urban, we're both fans of him. He's been doing great. This Kripke-led cast is just doing fantastic. Jack Quaid, he's going to be a fixture, I think, for years to come. He's proving his worth quite well in this show. He is incredibly likable. And he is our way into the show, the way to try and be as close to, having that empathetic, having that touchstone to be able to try and feel like it's the right, feel like it's as close to us as we can be. He's the normal guy, right? Anthony Starr is still doing fantastic as a maniacal Homelander. I like what they're doing with Aaron Moriarty's Starlight. Jesse T. Usher's as A-Train. Just all good stuff. Laz Alonso, Mother's Milk, doing great. They decided to go a slightly different direction than I expected with Chase Crawford's The Deep. He seems to be getting a lot of the really, really neat writing bits, the alterations to his character, just his stuff is just so off the wall so many times, and he also has to deal with some, he's had to have some very serious subject matter as part of his character exploration and growth, or lack thereof. It just to see him kind of see what it would look like if, when somebody gives up, when that person is just not very smart and has just chosen to, all right, fine, I'll fall in line. I will be the, I will be the stormtrooper behind the evil authoritarian that Homelander becomes, or that has always been. But I tell you what, Karen Fukuhara, to have somebody as interesting as Kimiko in this particular show, and not being able to speak, it's all sign language, so a lot of it has to be done with body language and facial expression and interaction in that way with other people, and she does a great job being able to emote in a way that we can kind of get behind. Bringing in people like Susan Hayward as Sister Sage, she just is dynamite in this show. She's so much fun to watch. Claudia Dumit continues to be pretty excellent as Victoria Newman. Valerie Curry does a great job. Her character, I find to be annoying because it's too real for me. Colby Menifee as Ashley Barrett, just these people are all just firing on all cylinders in this particular season, and I can't tell you how much I like the direction they're going with this, because in this rather dark version of our world that they've created, it's got to get darker before they have a chance of any sort of salvation, which I hope that's not too much of a, I think it's more of a story thing than a real life thing. But that definitely seems to be the direction that they're going. And then they give us this moment towards the end of the season where it looks like maybe, just maybe, we're going to get a little bit of an upturn, a little bit of a positive thing. You know, Frenchie and Kimiko finally find a place where they can appreciate each other. It looks like maybe, just maybe, that Billy Butcher is leaving his bad choices behind, and Huey and Starlight can kind of find a place of, you know, being in a better spot in their relationship, and Mother's Milk maybe will get a chance to just relax. maybe be with his family a little bit, you know, and there are certain elements that it ends up working, like, you know, A-Train kind of comes around, he does the right thing in the end, whereas Ashley gets kind of backed into a corner and feels like she has to choose the becoming a super as the only way she's going to potentially live. I'm kind of concerned to see what she's going to become. her character is already pretty messed up. But that's pretty interesting. Seeing the Newman character die was kind of rough. I liked that character quite a bit. I think Cameron Crivetti's doing really good with his role as Ryan. It's 'cause that's a hard role for a kid. I mean, there's getting nuance when you're a young actor is really rough. It's not something that comes across easily. And I think he's doing an admirable job. I mean, as well as he needs to make it come across in the right kind of way. But then having everybody at the end of the season just kind of get rounded up, except for Starlight, that was kind of a rough season ender, seeing that it was all basically part of the plan in the first place that Sister Sage came up with. It's like that part was not terribly surprising, the fact that she orchestrated so much of it. And if you're really going to have a super whose ability is just being able to kind of predict everything because they're that smart, yeah, of course they had this planned. And there's no way that it was going to end when she got thrown off the seven or whatever. It's like, right, sure, not a chance, not a chance. She would have been able to manipulate whatever she wanted and in whatever way she wanted, and that's exactly what happened. This is a show to watch. Now, obviously, I'm not going to give any sort of score on this because it's a show rather than a movie, and Richard may end up doing a score on the movie second half of this. But I'm not going to. Oh, and the end for Huey's dad, but the way they did the phasing powers was so good. They just keep topping themselves over and over and over. It's just awesome. I hope that season 5 continues to be just as good. I'm looking forward to it. This is, like I said, just kind of a short but sweet episode. This isn't going to be a long week because next week we're going to have a fantastic interview coming. So I always like to leave a little more time on those particular episodes. And, of course, we're going to be doing a review of the new Venom film coming out here very shortly as well. That's 2 weeks out. But I'm curious to see what Mr. Geiger thinks of his war film. We both have kind of a thing for war films, so take it away, Richard.
Thank you, Ken, for the feed-in to a surprising addition to this particular segment. Now, in the past, we've discussed the shows together. We like to do that together. We actually did our discussion about The Boys, Season 4, Part 1, together. But in doing Season 2, you know, I kind of felt out of the loop a little bit. I had watched those shows basically as they were released, and I had completed watching all of the episodes about, 3 months ago. And so my review of The Boys, the second part of Season 4, would not have been as thoughtful as what I thought it could be. So I suggested an alternative. I will still say that the second part of The Boys Season 4 was phenomenal. It's a great show all the way around. I love the narrative that they push in your face in this, because it's really just almost a mirror image of what's been happening in the country. And it's put in superhero land, but it's really left a big buildup for the conclusion, the final season, Season 5. So I'm really looking forward to that. But what I'm here to do then is throw my input on something a little different. Just recently, I had watched a movie that had been pushed to digital. It had been in theaters for a bit. And as movies do nowadays, they kind of move to digital quickly. They'll hang out in the theater for, a month, 6 weeks. If they're a really good movie, they'll hang out for maybe a couple months. Then a little bit later, they'll show up on some streaming service. What I'm going to be discussing today is the movie The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. I don't know if anybody got a chance to see this particular one. It happens to be streaming now on Stars. Now, I know a lot of folks aren't going to have Stars. We just happen to have it because there's a couple shows that we enjoy on there. And I'm telling you, if you haven't watched the Spartacus shows, they are elite. They are top tier. They are S tier. Please watch the Spartacus shows if you have Stars and you have access to them. They are some of my favorite shows of all time. Anyway, on to a discussion, the review. I'll do a standard review like we do. We'll go over all the categories. We'll give the points out of 100. Whatever our score total is at the end, that's what we've got, right? Kind of graded on a scale, if you will, from A, B, C, D, E, F, G, if you want to. So if a movie gets a 60, that's still a passing score. And it's, not as bad as maybe what people think it is. Have we ever hit 100? Nope. But we have some reviews in the 90s. Okay. Usually when we do these reviews, we tend to go in a certain form. And I'll stick to that. There's no need to reverse anything. We'll just go right down the list in kind of the standard order that we've done in the past, and I will start with one of the big categories, the cast. And I think to an extent that is the star of this particular movie. It's the cast. And I don't know if people are familiar with some of the cast. I want to say that people are definitely familiar with a good portion of the cast, but this is star power, and I can't really say it in a different way. It's star power with just an excellent ensemble. If we look at the premise of the movie, it's loosely based on some events around World War II. The German U-boats were dominating. They were decimating all of the supply routes all around Europe, but in particular from the U.S. to Europe. And this is an interpretation of some documents that were recently released, I think within the last 10 years or so, 20 years, I can't remember. It's at the beginning of the movie, of a let's call it an off the books mission that was put together to help, I don't know, subdue the U-boats that were causing that and delaying the U.S. from being able to get involved on this side of the ocean, on this side of the Atlantic is what I should say. Okay, so the cast. The main, I guess you could say the main star is going to be one Henry Cavill. You know, he's kind of had that actioner type of role in a lot of the things he's done recently. And this, you get that same kind of actioner role with the, well, okay, so if you know anything about Guy Ritchie movies, and this movie is a Guy Ritchie movie, then you know how the cheeky British presentation is in a lot of the movies. That's what you're going to get out of really all of these characters. Henry Cavill plays the main character. He has to assemble a team to do a mission. We'll get into that in the plot a little bit. You got Alan Ritchson in it. If you don't know who Alan Ritchson is, he was Dove in, the one show that's on Max, Titans. Yes. But I think if you've been paying attention and you've been watching awesome shows on Amazon, he's Jack Reacher in the Reacher series, and he's great. And this one, he kind of plays a Dutchman, effeminate Dutchman, but hunting and just an absolute killing machine. I mean, he cut out someone's heart in one of the scenes and, you know, like, hey, this is what I'd like to do. The only thing, well, that's a bad accent, but he kind of has a bad accent, but it's not detracting at all. Alex Pettyfer shows up a little bit later into the movie, but he's still one of the main characters. Now, you might not have seen Alex Pettyfer in a lot of things. He was in Time. Oh, what is that, about 13 years ago? He was in Magic Mike, just a little bit after that. And he's been in a lot of shows off and on. I think if you saw him, you would recognize his face because he's been in so many things. It's just that you might not know who he is recently. You know who Isa Gonzalez is. You've seen her quite a bit. You might not know, okay, one of Ken and I's favorite things, especially for Ken, is to pronounce names. So I'll do my best. Babs Alusnamikun. Perfect. I nailed it. Okay, so he was one of the main characters in this show, but he's been in so many things. Most recently, you would have seen him in parts 1 and 2 of Dune. But he's been in a lot of really cool shows over the years. He stands out quite a bit. You'd recognize his face if you saw him. He was in The Defenders, Gotham, a few other shows. But I remember him from being in the Dune movies most recently. And Cary Elwes, you would know who Cary Elwes. You know, I've been saying this so much in the last couple weeks, and no one gets the reference. I keep saying, like, because we're talking, for some reason, Lincoln comes up. Oh, did you see the picture of Lincoln in the background? And I keep saying, hey, Blinken, and no one gets it. Or, like, I will say, did you say Abe Lincoln? No, I said, hey, Blinken. You guys would get it. I hope you would get that. Anyway, I'll move on to a couple other folks here. Hero Finds Tiffin showed up as one of the main characters. Henry Golding was in here. Rory Kinnear. Now, Rory Kinnear's been in a few things. I saw him as Penny Dreadful, about 10 years ago. But he's been in a lot of the more recent Bond movies as well. He's been in the Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, as Tom Bombadil. Man, this dude is everywhere. everywhere. Till Schweiger has been in this, and he was in this. He plays your prototypical German, let's say. He's great at it. He's awesome. He really is good. Oh, and top secret, probably my favorite part in the entire show, was played by Danny Sapani. Same thing. Danny Sapani was in Penny Dreadful, but he's had other roles in, you know, like Black Panther, for example. Honestly, like I said, I kind of thought his role stole the show. He was awesome. He was very good. He's one of my favorite parts of the entire show. But the cast overall, very strong. Definitely the strongest suit of the movie. I can't really say too much bad about it. There are some things off and on that kind of distracted me a little bit about the cast. Like I said, the fake accent, it wasn't bad. It wasn't good. Anyway, the cast was really strong. Out of 20, I give this one a solid 18. Well, that's not true. 19. Like I said, there's not much to go wrong on this cast. Everybody was really good. They had fun doing it. You could tell. Very good. Okay, so the next category, director. There's not much to say on this one, right? Director's going to get what they can out of the people. They're going to portray a story. It's Guy Ritchie. If you've seen Guy Ritchie movies, then you know what you're going to get. If you watched Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, if you watched Snatch, and that's what you kind of grew up on as, you know, those types of movies when, you know, we were younger watching movies, then you know exactly the type of dialogue, action, you know the things that you are going to get. Since he's also the writer, you've got to give him, you know, a little bit more credit, or, you know, lack of credit, because it was his source material as well. But what you get with the Guy Ritchie stuff is sequences of things, memories, backtracking, if you will, explosions, and dialogue, some subtle humor in things, carrying things in a certain way, a certain pace to it, camera angles that deliver expressions, storytelling. This is for sure a Guy Ritchie movie, and I'm not saying that in a bad way. But what I will say is, if you go into this movie knowing that this is a Guy Ritchie movie and you're expecting more, I don't know what, why. If you're going to this movie and you're like, I love Guy Ritchie movies, and you come out of it like, oh, that wasn't it. I think you're totally, you must have missed something. So like I said, there's not much to say about this particular direction. Pretty standard for this director and this type of movie. I gave it 11 out of 15, so not too bad. Okay, so next category, locations. The locations really kind of take place in a handful of areas. You know, you have some spots in like the British Ministry of Defense areas. So like you see, let's call them offices, but where the communications are happening, where all the research is being done. You see a lot on the ocean on a boat. There's an island that has a prison. There is the main island that houses the main body of the story. We're not talking about anything crazy in terms of locations. It's just that what you got was what you needed to get. It wasn't like it was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. Like when you look at the landscapes, there were some really nice shots. There were some nice shots that kind of offset with some mountains in the background, like coastlines with mountain regions on the background, going up against, you know, maybe some sun, some clouds. You really got some good views, but nothing that was going to, you know, bring the movie down. Nothing was going to just make this the most amazing thing ever. Don't need to go on too much on this one. I think, you know, you could have probably shown off some of the locations a little bit more snazzier, but I just give it an 8. Pretty good. Next category is going to be props. So props, how can I describe this? Everything looked good, except some of the things just didn't look good. I guess one of my main things in doing this, and maybe I'm overanalyzing this, and I do it when I watch movies, but I tend to watch more or pay attention to more World War II things. And you could really tell the ships that they had kind of crafted and the buildings they had crafted and the 88s they had crafted were just kind of cheesily low budget put together. I'm no expert on costuming and props when it comes to this era. It just looked like some of the things were moderately accurate, but not spot on accurate. Although the casual outfits, right? So when we're talking, when I say casual, the people wearing their khakis and their shirts, that stuff looked sharp. That was snappy. The headdresses that people had, whether it was a hat, whether it was a bandana, whatever it was, those looked good. Henry Cavill's mustache looked tremendous. The glasses that were worn were, you know, exactly what you'd expect from the 40s or someone getting their things from the UK, from Britain would be. So there's a lot of good. Now, once again, I'm no expert. They shot a lot of silenced weapons. And I know when we play video games, when you put a silencer on things, nobody hears the silenced weapons, right? That's the whole point of them. But does that really happen? Because a lot of the actions that they did through this were them, you know, casually shooting people with silenced automatic weapons. And this is the 40s, mind you. I just can't imagine that them shooting those silenced weapons were so stinking quiet that no one else would have heard anything of the gunshots going on. I kept thinking about that every time. It was the whole part of the movie was the concealment piece, but the extreme casual nature of them using them as well, as if no one would have ever heard any shot ever with any of those weapons because they had a silencer on them. I'm probably overanalyzing that, but still, I just kept thinking of that the whole time. Otherwise, a lot of the stuff did actually look nice, not too detracting. Saw a couple dresses, but more. There. Let's be honest. In this entire one, there was one female character. Is she the only one? Isa Gonzalez. The entire time? No. Okay. There were very, very few female characters in this. Isaac Gonzalez was the main one. There was a couple characters that showed up at the party sequence at the end. And, you know, the outfits, the dresses that the women had on, sharp, looked very good. Isaac Gonzalez always looked sharp in what she was wearing. There was a train sequence. You know what? The train sequence inside the interior of the train looked pretty good as well. So, like I said, I just had some nitpicky things that maybe I paid way more attention to than what I should have. So for the props, I'm going to give that a solid 7. Let's move on to the cinematography. Cinematography on this one, you got to look at it from a certain landscape of wide shots, close shots, explosions. And I think what I got out of some of this was a little over-exaggeration of some of the things in terms of the explosions that you got. It's Guy Ritchie, after all. Some of the delivering of the firearms and their shooting automatic weapons, single-shot weapons, those were good. Now, when Alan Ritchton's character goes in and just like goes all ham on people, knifing the crap out of them, that stuff, he has some type of training from doing all the other things he's done, especially Reacher. So his stuff looked great, natural. A lot of the fighting sequence didn't look forced at all. The handling of the firearms, like I said, very casual. It's not like people were aiming and shooting. There was a lot of just hip fire shots on this. A lot of those with silenced weapons, shooting up close or from moderate distances. Okay. you know, that's the vibe of this movie. It wasn't like they were being top secret and wore the face paint and the masks and they hid behind bushes. No, they just kind of walked through the middle of these places and shot at people and didn't really care. Like, that was the casual nature of the deliverance of the vibe of the movie. But from the cinematography standpoint, the fight sequences, like I said, looked fine, looked natural. The wide shots for, you know, the scope of things. The upfront shots when you're doing, you know, a one-on-one, when you look at the Isaac Gonzalez and the Til Schweiger conversations, you got a really great vibe with those because of how the camera moved how it should be. Not moved, but like was positioned correctly. The cuts were made exactly how you wanted them to be. She had her conversations with Babs as well on the train. Those look sharp. So I think everything on the cinematography front, honestly, things can be overdone. And trust me, in this, things were overdone. Some of the things were a bit overstated, but that's kind of what they needed to be. So I get that. But I'm not going to say really too much bad about the cinematography. Out of 15, I did a 12. So solid score on that one. Speaking of score, the next category, the score. There are always going to be music notes. There's always going to be song. There's always going to be song and dance. There's always going to be some type of presentation at the forefront of a Guy Ritchie film. And I think in this one, you got a lot of that same deliverance. Your score delivered tempo, a delivered pace. Your score kept everybody interested, but the score also worked in the background to not detract from anything. What I can say on this one, because we'll keep it short and sweet, the score fit the narrative. Songs were picked accurately. They didn't detract. 8 out of 10. Done. Okay. So let's get into the plot. Now, usually this is where things can tank, right? But in this one, I'll go with the plot taken from a real life mission in World War II. So like I said, the whole point was the Germans had a base in West Africa. It was a Spanish held location, but the Germans held the base there. The idea was if the British bombed it to destroy it, it would have brought other people into the war. Because it wasn't necessarily a war territory, they weren't going to bring war to that territory. So whatever they did had to be unsanctioned. If the Germans caught them, they would be killed or they would be imprisoned. If the British caught them, because the British were patrolling, you know, the Atlantic, trying to cut down on trade routes for the Germans, they would be arrested. So they were doing things completely off the record books. And the idea was at this base off the coast of West Africa. So really, Africa has the bigger part in the north and it kind of tapers down. But on the western part of Africa, kind of where like the Ivory Coast is, it kind of circles around and then goes down. Like that little bend in Africa is where this was at. And the base that was there housed some equipment for basically rearming, readjusting, I'll go over into one specific thing. basically making the U-boats functional. So if there was an issue with them, this is where they go to get their maintenance, basically. But the big one was the carbon scrubbers, because when you were underwater for so long, you had to have something that scrubbed the carbon dioxide, or else you would just suffocate under the sea, right? It's not like these U-boats were going like miles underwater. They didn't have that capability. But still, they would be under there for long periods of time. They had to scrub the carbon, or you just got carbon dioxide poisoning, actually. The monoxide would have been the exhaust from the diesel engines, but that shouldn't have been too much inside the submarine. Anywho, what happened at this place is they had a big boat and two tugboats. And when the U-boats would come in, the tugs would move around and they go to this boat, and this boat would do all of the maintenance for these U-boats. So it was an important location. The thought process from the British, according to this storyline, was we can't take out the U-boats. We're having trouble with that. So why don't we take out the things that are maintaining the U-boats? And if they can't function properly, then they can't function to do their job that they're doing in the Northern Atlantic, taking out all those trade routes. So this is the mission. They bring in a person who has been in jail, but he is just right for the job, of course. And he's like, I'll only do this if I get my own crew. Of course, perfect. So the crew that they have to wrangle up, they get from, you know, they tell the story of this person getting the crew in, and why these people aren't good people. You know, they're bad people. Then the one important part of the crew member that they have to pick up, and there's no way around it, this person's going to be on the crew, because when I was in the bunker, he got me out of the bunker, and he's the only reason that I'm alive. We're going to go rescue him. He's going to be the main brains on this operation. So they had to make a pit stop along the way at a prison. So that's part of the subplot, is they had to go to a prison to bust out this other person. You know, it's just a lot of these things are so convenient. I don't know how I'm guessing the story isn't, obviously the basis of the story is accurate, but the logistics of the story are probably just way overblown. Anyway, that's the first thing. So they assemble the crew. They go down to, you know, your introduction is them on a sailboat getting intercepted by a German boat. The German boat, obviously patrolling the seas, goes into their boat and to search for stowaways, to search for, you know, whatever is going to be on there. And that's how you're introduced to the band of characters. Then let's go shift backwards and tell the story of where the characters came from and how they're there. Okay, now we're going to go forward and we're going to rescue the buddy from this prison, and they just annihilate everybody at the prison like it was nothing, and then they have a plan. Anyway, so there's all these convenient plans and schemes and plots, and they're great soldiers. And you think in these types of movies, and maybe because it's a Guy Ritchie movie, it's not going to happen, but you think in these types of movies, there's always going to be something bad that happens. Someone's going to get killed. The plan's going to go awry. But in this particular one, everything just works. One of the characters got shot in the shoulder. They were going to go and blow up the ship. Oh, but the ship had reinforced things on the bottom. Change of plans. We're going to steal the ship by pulling it out with those two tugboats. Okay, fine. Now, I don't, once again, this could be part of the true story. But everything just works out so conveniently. It's almost like you're anticipating something happening, right? The interaction with the Isaac Gonzalez, Till Schweiger, those characters, you're like, oh yeah, this is actually going to not end well, because the Till Schweiger character is a really bad German character, and he's mean, and he's going to, you know, cut her into pieces because he found out that she was a spy. And so, you know, come to that little spot where you think something's going to happen. She's just got a concealed gun, shoots him in the head, and then they get away in the end. Like, there's, you have minor parts of conflagration, but it's just like when you're at work and you're supposed to do something and then something changes the plans. You're like, okay, I'm going to go, you know, make adjustments because I have something else to do. And then you get it done and that's the end. Maybe for some of you, that's not how that works, but that's how the movie worked. Very little got in the way. And when something got in the way, it was just like, So the whole thing that I did find fascinating is if you read some of the notes on this, and even the main character, it's all just kind of what some of the basis for the James Bond character actually came from was these set of characters. This set of people in the 40s in World War II. So that part I found pretty fascinating. And I think the main character's name was like Ian Fleming. So like, come on. Okay. So that part was interesting, but even the notes at the end, it said that in part because he, you know, had a friend who was in this is where Ian Fleming loosely based his James Bond character was. All these guys and their suave ways and their, you know, behind the scenes dealings or off the books workings for the British government. So overall, there was a lot of, I'll say nothing more than I think the story was told how it needed to be. There was just a lot of convenience when it came to the plot, but there wasn't any like weird loopholes. Just a lot of convenience. No more. No less. And for that, I'll give the plot a solid 14 out of 20. So when we do the totals for everything on here, honestly, a solid movie, 79 out of 100. That gets you like almost to a B. You know, I can't tell you if you would like this movie. I just think generally speaking, if you like the actors, you like Guy Ritchie movies, for sure, you'll love this one. If you like period pieces, yeah, this is just another, this is kind of one of those. It's not going to be true to form in any sense, but it's nice. It's fun. If you like action movies, this has action in it for sure. And it's nothing over the top. It's nothing that's bad. It's just one of those, you can sit down and watch this. It's about an hour and 45 minutes. It's not going to kill your day to watch this. It's actually pretty solid. So I would recommend a watch if you have the hour and 45 minutes and, of course, you have Stars. If this ever rolls out to another platform and you're like, I don't know if I want to watch that or not, I'd say give it a shot. It's not too bad. What are your thoughts, dear listeners? Have you got a chance to watch this? Did you go watch it in the theater? Are you looking to pick it up on streaming? Let us know. Just because, you know what? We love the feedback and we don't really ever get it. So we don't know from time to time if what we're discussing really has any type of bearing on anything. So we will see you next week. Ken has an awesome interview that he's performed here recently. We'll have that up for next week's episode. So stay tuned.